We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens. What kind of radio show is this?
Kudos to you for digging into these things, because, you know, a lot of other people would just completely throw out the channel or stories and would have missed, you know, this amazing Fagerstrom story. And this other one, too.
Yeah, well, this is true. But you see, once again, it's like, for example, astronomers who take pictures of the moon, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, and I look at the pictures and I say to these astronomers, I'm a member of an observatory here, and I say, wow, these images of the moon you took are amazing. They're so clear. I mean, they're like high resolution. And he goes, yeah, but you don't know how many shots I had to take in order to get these.
Yeah.
The same thing with channelers. You don't know how many channelers I had to go through and put up with all the crap before I got something that was real. And I believe the longer you delve into this, you go into this, sooner or later, as a paranormal investigator, if you're really out there in the field, if you're really doing it, you know, not just, you know, doing it for fun or a hobby or just seeing if you get your name in the paper or a reality show or something like that. If you're really out there with the cases, sooner or later, you're going to experience something and see that this stuff is all very real. And then it's going to become a reality to you. And that just may change your mind. I know, for example, many UFO paranormal investigators that have quit investigations because they experienced something and it was no longer a fun thing to do on the weekend to get, you know, away from the wife or the family.
Mm-hmm.
and let your imagination run away with you, a plaything, a hobby. It became a reality and it scared them and they got out of it.
Yeah, well, it can be very scary. Like I said, this ancient evil force would probably put me off for a while about.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, ancient evil force. I really don't know exactly what that means.
Yeah.
Maybe it was my ex-wife. I don't know. I mean, but yes, over the years, I think I've been fortunate enough, and it's almost like a coincidence that I've always been in the right place at the right time.
Hmm.
I mean, probably my investigation of the paranormal would have been totally different had I not lived in the New York area when all of these sightings in the Hudson Valley took place back in the 80s. And that's what triggered me into the world of the paranormal back then. And like I said, as you read my books, you see how I'm putting all of these pieces together over the years. And then, you know, of course, I get some critics that say, oh, you know, John Keel and Ivan Sander, they said this a long time ago. This is true. You know, John Keel was a very good friend of mine. But John did say a lot of this stuff a long time ago. But I'm the first one to actually put the case studies there and actually put the scientific information of theoretical physics into the idea of parallel universes. John Keel just said, oh, they're from a parallel universe, but here in my books, Interdimensional Universe, and my new book coming out in December of 2011 called Portals, really focuses in on the physics of how these other dimensions exist and how these other dimensions interact with ours, producing phenomena that we only get a fleeting glimpse of.
Yeah. Well, I've never really understood that attitude anyway in ufology and in the paranormal, where it's like, well, somebody already said that. Well, it's like, well, you know, people are still performing Shakespeare. I mean, come on.
So it's true. You know, people said, you know, just because, you know, we say, oh, you, what are we doing about Jupiter? Galileo looked at Jupiter, you know, back in 1620. You know, what are we going there now with spacecraft for? But you see, Keel did say, you know, about the idea of other dimensions and other universe where UFOs come from. But really, I'm the first one to put the theoretical idea of physics behind it and explain it all in detail. You have to remember, the UFO people, the people involved with UFO, not really the investigators, the armchair investigators, the one who read the books, all the books, and think they're an expert on it now, these people are probably the most critical. Out of all the paranormal fields, the people in UFOs are the most critical of all. John Keel said once that, Phil, why don't you just, you you know, cut out UFOs and just investigate the paranormal. He goes, you know, the UFO phenomena, the people involved there are the lepers of the paranormal. You know that, don't you? I said, what? But it's been, you know, it's been my luck and it's been my fortune to work with people like Keel, to work with people like J. Allen Hynek, to work with people like John Fuller, and, you know, other people who were actually pioneers in the field that build a foundation of what we have today. And unfortunately, we haven't built too much of that foundation in the last 15 years, but I believe we're on the verge of a new emergence of at least understanding the phenomena.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. And I've kind of pointed that out on the program, too, over the past few years. It does seem like there's a trend moving toward a more multidisciplined approach and that sort of thing than it was when I first got into it. So it seems like people are turning in that direction because the lack of answers may be a big part of that. You know, it's time to take a fresh look at all this and see if it connects in some way, as you're saying.
And also, you see, you have to remember also that people are doing this as sort of a hobby on the weekend.
Yeah.
They're doing it with practically, you know, money from their own pockets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would have never gone to the moon if we had to depend upon people who would work on the weekends in their spare time as sort of a hobby,
yeah,
financing the whole thing. And, you know, somebody, when Dr. Hynek was on the Good Morning America one time, and he was staying at my place, and then we went down to the city, and he went on to Good Morning America. One of the persons said, well, you've been doing this for so many years. What have you found out? And he used to say the same thing. He used to say, you know, you're depending upon people that practically are working on a shoestring budget, that are working in their spare time. And we would have never made the scientific discoveries we have today if we had to depend upon people, you know, to work with that. But also, you see, there are many people in the UFO field who are like, you know, it's very territorial,
mm-hmm,
and people do not cooperate. And the fact is that unless in the future someone produces like $100, $200, $300 million or something like that and takes the best of the best and puts them together in a team to go out there and explore the paranormal, let's say for 5 years, and then at the end of that 5 years produce, you know, a book, a paper on their findings, that they would be able to investigate all of these cases and practically have no expenses spared for equipment and traveling expenses and so on and so on. If this were to happen, then I believe we would be on the verge of understanding what all this means. But until that day takes place, with all of these loose, you know, sort of like clans of UFO people running around doing their own thing, not cooperating with the other clans, you know, the clans are different belief systems.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen.
Well, do you think that was sort of attempted by Bob Bigelow and the NIDS organization? Although that seems maybe that was less aimed at unlocking the paranormal than maybe owning the paranormal, you know, a proprietary thing. If they could figure out what was going on, then they could, you know, use it in industry or something like that.
Well, you know, I don't think it was done to that extreme. I'm talking about, you know, a big budget thing with,
yeah,
hand-picked people from many different fields that are also, you know, have some background in the UFO phenomena. Actually, Peter Gersten tried it one time. And he was going to put an organization together called Contact.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually flew in people from all over the place. And I was a member of that organization. So it was Bud Hopkins and Peter Robbins. And it looked like, you know, it was a dream come true. And then it just fell apart. And for why it fell apart, you know, I'm still not sure today. But one day, you know, Peter just got, I think, disillusioned by the whole Contact experience and decided that, you know, it wasn't worth it. Some people claim in the group that they were approached by certain people who were from the government or Men in Black and told that the organization would never, never start and that they should not get involved with it. And some people did back out because of certain threats. I've never been threatened except just before the publication of Night Siege, of course, as I make it clear, you know, I was contacted by the Air Force And I've been contacted by a number of government agencies, and I've been contacted, and of course, when I was investigating the sightings of the UFOs over the Indian Point nuclear reactor, I received quite a bit of friction from New York state government and federal government, and military concerning, you know, the information that I had about the encounters over there. Yeah, I mean, that was strange. I mean, I was the first civilian since 1969 to be directly contacted, officially contacted by the United States Air Force in regards to my UFO investigations.
Yeah, yeah, very strange stuff. Now, you mentioned in the book, and you also mentioned it when I was down there in Putnam Valley, you say in the book that there's rumors of a secret organization within the government attempting to capture an interdimensional entity to unlock the secret of travel between the dimensions. Can you extrapolate a little bit more on that? Because I found that really intriguing, and it may just be, you know, nothing more than shadowy rumors, but I'd definitely like to hear more about it if you know any more about it.
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard this before, and down in Pine Bush, New York, at one time there was a lot of activity down there, a lot of military presence. On one particular case that is really well documented, by the way, the military came in and they closed off almost an entire neighborhood, and not allowing anybody in or out, went to the doors, knocked on people, and told everybody to stay in. And that people were looking out their windows and seeing jeeps coming down, helicopters coming in, and they were told it was just a training exercise. Obviously, they were looking for something, and my contacts tell me that, you know, these dimensional beings have been merging in and out of dimensions, and the United States military and a secret group was brought in, and they're supported by the military to try to capture one of these beings to get the technology. Now, it doesn't stop there, because in my book coming out that I co-authored with Rosemary Ellen Guiley called The Vengeful Djinn,
oh, yeah,
that's coming out in March. And I focus on my adventures or misadventures or whatever you want to call them in the Middle East. And to make a very long story short, I have a friend over there who I served with in the military, who was a colonel in the Saudi security force for the royal family. Well, to make a long story short, I had dinner with one of the royal family members with all of these other people who were invited. And he just leaned over and said to me, "Why are you in my country?" And I said, "I'm researching the djinn." He goes, "The djinn?" He said, "My government has been trying to capture one of them. And the United States government and the European government, they come together in my country and they try to capture one."
Wow.
And I said, "Well, did they ever get one?" And they said, "No." He said he didn't know, because it would be security of the highest level. I said, "What do they want?" He said they want to get their technology. Now, when I was in Oman, I then picked up a story from a person who was a teacher who claimed they encountered one of these dimensional beings in the Hajar Mountains, where I was going, mm-hmm. to a place called the place of the djinn, the meeting place of the djinn, a big cave, Majas al Djinn. And he said that he encountered a female of one of these species, a Janaya, and he got very terrified. And the Janaya sort of like saw him, looked at him, and then sensed something was wrong and sort of like ran to a distance and disappeared into like a portal. All of a sudden, he says, helicopters come over the hills in jeeps. And these military people picked him up, took him to a secret base, and debriefed him, asking him what they saw and everything. And it was obvious that they were trying to capture one of these djinn to see how they merge in and out of our dimension using a certain technology, perhaps. And this fellow was so scared to talk. He was more afraid of the military presence that picked him up than the idea of seeing this entity, this djinn. And this is like on two different parts of the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. I hear the same story about a secret organization, not only in the United States government, but that's made up of certain governments of the world, a special unit that is trying to capture one of these dimensional beings to obtain their technology. And I heard it on two different locations. When the cousin of the prince of Saudi Arabia told me the story about how they're trying to capture it, that just, you know, shocked me right there.
Yeah, absolutely. The point you make here about them trying to capture the interdimensional entity for its technology also sort of highlights, in a sense, the short-sightedness that you hear when you hear these rumors about the government. It's always like they make a deal with the aliens to get their weapons and stuff. It's like, I find it troubling, I guess you could say, that if there is people within the government who are looking for this thing, looking to unlock the mystery of the paranormal, it's always, you know, towards a military end or something like that. It's never, you know, for the betterment of mankind. It's for how to destroy the part of mankind we don't like anymore or something like that. It's very unfortunate in a way.
Well, the military is always involved in stuff like that. It's the history of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I mean, but we also have to remember that, you know, the dimensional beings, the djinn, may be part of it, and that there may also be other types of beings where the government has already made contact with. There was one particular case of a fellow in Connecticut, and when I went to go see him, he almost sounded crazy. And he talked about these entities appearing in front of him and talking to him, saying that he was, you know, going to be part of some type of world-shattering event. But what really got me about this guy is that when I talked to him in 1980,
mm-hmm.
he said that they came and got him in his bed, and he said he was partially drugged, and he says he's pretty sure that the people who were taking him were human.
Yeah.
They took him out of his bedroom and they put him into a vehicle, and he said he was going in and out of consciousness, and he came to a road, a dirt road, with a sign that said, "Welcome to Southeast."
Huh.
Now, this guy lives in Milford, Connecticut. He had no idea there was even a town called Southeast. He said from there, he thinks he drove up a dirt road that had a gate in front of it and was taken into some underground establishment. And there he saw a laboratory with humans and your typical gray aliens. He was put into a room, all his clothes were taken off, and they came in and they rubbed something on him, somebody or some guys, and out of the other room, he said, came a female alien, which he proceeded to have sex with. And then, I mean, this sounds crazy.
Yeah.
But this was told to me in 1980. Then all of a sudden, I found a road that was a dirt road that's with a sign that said, "Welcome to Southeast."
Oh, wow.
And get this. In that area, there are underground iron ore mines that were being used by the government at one time in the past. Now, I didn't get into that area until the 1990s. But here I had this case in the 80s, and I just filed the case away as being, you know, part of the crazy stuff. Yet, now in the 1990s, it all starts coming together,
mm-hmm.
and I get this information from this case, pull it out, and I said, oh my gosh, this guy couldn't have known that there were these underground passageways in the Brewster Southeast area that are old abandoned mines. And, of course, in the 1990s, I explored these underground passages and mines. And they're flooded now, and someone went through quite a bit of trouble to collapse some of the tunnels so you couldn't get into some particular areas. But this is what I mean. You get some of these cases, and they sound crazy as hell. But then somewhere down the line, you're doing research, and this information seems to fill in gaps of what you're doing now. This fella, this verifies his story almost. There's no way that he could have even known the location of these mines. They were unknown for the last 100 years.
And you make the point, too, in the book that, you know, when you talk about the airplanes at Stewart Airport, you know, some of the stuff that the government says is shut down really isn't shut down. They just don't want you to know they're still using this stuff.
Well, that's true. You know, that's an old, that was an old part of that Stewart Air Base was an old SAC field, mm-hmm. Strategic Air Command, and they used to keep the B-52 bombers underground. So in that so-called abandoned area, which the runway was being kept really nice and everything was going on there, there was there's an underground establishment there. And, you know, I've followed a number of planes there at night. Well, the whole team did. I had a team of people. We're all in contact by radio. We saw these planes that were trying to emulate a UFO in the sky land in this field. They circled. They went down one at a time. And it was obvious that, you know, that they were military. Also, there was a lot of things going on at that field.
Yeah.
And also at Stewart itself. You know, they have C-5A galaxies coming in and landing there. And I did a Freedom of Information Act. I did an investigation. The United States Department of Agriculture was in there doing something top secret. And finally, recently, I put it together. And I was wondering why so many shipments of cattle were coming in on C-5As.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, what the hell's going on here? What are all these cattle? I have all these shipments, all these documents, cattle. But they would not. They would black out their final destination. Who is bringing all the – why is the military bringing in all of these cattle? Well, somebody told me, oh, the aliens are using it for blood and parts and stuff for cattle mutilation. No. I finally figured out where the cattle was going. It was going to Plum Island out in Long Island Sound.
Huh.
Where they're doing research out there for developing viruses and stuff in cattle and livestock. That's a top secret island off the coast of Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
Where since the World War II, they've been doing secret research involving, you know, viral infections,
yeah,
and bacterial infections. I'm sure you've heard of Plum Island.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
But those cattle were going there.
Interesting.
And, I mean, you know, that just opens up another book of worms, you know, another can of worms.
Wow.
But you see how all these pieces fit together when you're doing UFO investigation? You have to be like a detective.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you get something that's puzzling and it doesn't fit into place, that doesn't mean that, you know, it's not going to be useful in the near future when you get the other pieces of the puzzle so you can put the picture together. And this is what I slowly did. I put all the pieces together and, you know, got a pretty broad picture of what's going on. And who knows what's going on in Plum Island? Some people even think that, you know, they've got aliens out there as their guests.
Now, one part of the book that damn near knocked me out of my seat was this story here about a Major Andrews. Here's what you say. The caller identified himself as Major Andrews and said that he was calling from Burlington, Massachusetts, which, as luck would have it, is where I am calling you from tonight, Burlington, Massachusetts.
And how about that?
I know, and it stunned me because we don't have any sort of military presence here. There's no base or anything like that. Was he calling from his home or his office, or can you shed some more light on that? Because, you know, that hits obviously very close to home for me.
Okay, well, it happened this way. I was preparing the manuscript for Night Siege.
Yeah.
And in the manuscript, I was I'm going to talk about the encounters at the Indian Point nuclear reactor. One day I get a letter from Washington, from the Pentagon, from a lieutenant colonel, saying that the Air Force was going to contact me in regards to my investigations into unidentified flying objects and the possibilities of violating areas of national security.
Yeah.
Really, like, well, I didn't know how the contact was going to take, but were they going to come to the door? You know, were they going to be men in black? I mean, you know, all of these scenarios went into my head. This was in the 80s.
Yeah.
One day, the phone rings, and it's this major. A Major Andrews. He's from, you know, he's calling from Burlington, Massachusetts. And he was in an office.
Interesting. Okay.
And now remember, just because he identifies himself as Major, that doesn't mean that he's actually in uniform.
Right.
Okay. I assumed he was a uniformed, you know, officer, a senior officer. And he started asking me all of these questions. And I really tried to get around it. For example, I tried to joke around with him saying, yes, I was in the military too. This guy didn't want to hear it. He had a job to do.
Mm-hmm.
It sounded like he was asking questions from a form that somebody else gave to him that he was supposed to get and get answers for.
Yeah.
So he was going through each question. And we were on the phone for 45 minutes.
Wow.
And finally he said that the United States Air Force is very concerned about the sightings in the Hudson Valley, and they don't want to start a UFO scare, and that they wanted me to send them whatever was going to be in that manuscript, which was, you know, only like half done at the time, to them, so that they can check it out. And they said they really don't want me to put any encounters that involve the Indian Point reactor in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I don't know if I can do that or not. And he said, well, if you cooperate with us, we'll cooperate with you. And over the weeks to follow, this was very bizarre. I mean, the phone call was bizarre anyway. This guy was like, you know, cold.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, you know, business, all business. There was no humor in his voice, nothing. And they sent me a package of documents, sort of like their cooperation, hoping that I'd send the manuscript in
mm-hmm.
return.
Yeah.
Showing that they're cooperating with me. Now, most of the documents were blacked out, but there were documents in there that were from FAA, air traffic controllers, asking what to do about UFO sightings, and also from Coast Guard about unidentified lights under the water in Long Island Sound. Also, one of the strangest things that was in that packet, and it must have got to me by mistake, there was a letter in there from a woman in Tennessee who had a close encounter with a triangular object, pretty detailed. Now, it was the original letter. It had the original signature and pen from this woman, but it was addressed to Bob Pratt, down who, you know, was the co-author of Night Siege.
Yeah.
The letter was dated from 1976. I called up Bob, and I said, Bob, you're not going to believe this. I got a letter that's addressed to you. He says, I investigated those cases for the when I was working for the Enquirer. He said, Phil, I never got that letter. So this tells me that in some cases, yes, you know, UFO stuff that involves a hot case that the government's interested in, they do intercept the mail.
Very interesting stuff. Yeah, I'll have to look more into this situation here, because this is a small town, too, so I don't understand, you know, how this guy was in Burlington, Mass., but I don't know. It's very puzzling to me.
Well, it's puzzling also, you know, that the letter came from Washington.
Yeah.
And that the phone call came from Burlington, Massachusetts. He may have been a field agent in the area.
That's possible, yeah. Yeah. Very strange.
You know, so when we talk about, you know, the Air Force and the military, and by the way, this Major Andrews never identified himself as an Air Force officer. He said the Air Force was concerned that he was getting this information for the Air Force. So he identified himself with the major rank, but he could have been any branch of the military.
Yeah.
If I remember the phone call and the information correctly, you know, I'm thinking, so, you know, he could have been an Air Force major, but that's not necessarily means he was. He could have been a member of the NSA or the CIA also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the same rank.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, given that you've been looking at this for like the last 30 years plus, obviously conclusions are hard to come by, but what do you think as far as, because this is always the tantalizing part that people seem to latch onto, you know, what do you think the government really knows about what's going on here with all this stuff?
Well, I don't know if they know much. I think there's a very select group in the governments of the world that are privileged with information.
Mm-hmm.
If probably the majority of Congress is completely ignorant about about the whole UFO situation.
Yeah.
There may be a few senior members who are privileged with top secret projects that are being conducted, like trying to capture a dimensional alien or stuff like that. But I'm sure there's involvement with the government, but you know, they keep a low profile. And they probably know this organization, which I've, you know, actually touched on the fringes of it from time to time. It popped up in my investigations from time to time. And I mentioned them in some of my books. That's, you know, these people who I've encountered that have contacted me. So I think it's a very select group in the government, a secret organization within the government that really doesn't answer to really anyone. Sort of like a black ops sort of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm very familiar with black ops operations, and they don't answer to anybody.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's a big government cover-up, but I do believe there is, you know, secret work being done by a secret organization in the governments of the world.
Right, right. Well, it kind of ties in to something that Rich Dolan sort of put out in his last book, the National Security State, Volume 2, sort of like a breakaway civilization, if you will. There's a group maybe that, you know, got a lot of this information, let's just say in the 40s or something like that. I mean, they were talking like two generations worth of people at this point. So it's like they're definitely separated from the rest of us in humanity, if you will, in some ways, by the sheer knowledge of what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you know, it seems that the original people who got involved with UFOs was Naval Intelligence.
Yeah.
And that sort of like worked their way into these intelligence organizations that have probably branched out into one particular organization that answers to probably some of the major intelligence organizations. You know, who controls, and they're probably members of the military. They probably have absolute control over, like if they want to get an entire company of Marines out somewhere, all they have to do is make a phone call and they get it.
Yeah.
Just like what happened in Pine Bush. I believe the military presence was just a smokescreen to keep the people in, but the real team that was out there trying to do this and capture this guy, this thing, or whatever it is, you know, you don't see them. You know, one of the movies I like the most is the movie Predator. Have you ever seen, like, Predator 2?
Yeah.
With Gary Busey's a member. He's the chief of this elite team that's trying to capture the Predator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was almost like, my gosh, this may be going on.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, I mean, there probably are a handful of people like that that's on a team that travels all around, that has complete control over local police and the military, that have all this equipment that are trying to capture one of these dimensional aliens for technology.
And when you look at it from that perspective, it makes the whole idea of disclosure to be sort of a non-issue, if you will. I don't know if the government could they disclose? I think that they don't really know, you know, the people in the power to disclose don't know what's going on, you know, as far as the president, people in Congress and stuff like that. And the people in the intelligence field, I don't know if they have the wherewithal or the inclination to disclose this information, because it sounds like if they're still trying to capture one of these interdimensional things, you know, they're still trying to catch up to what this is all about as well.
Well, that's true. And you're not going to have a disclosure when you have a very elite few that are holding the information. And these people aren't elected. These people, you know, stay in that position for life. And when they finally retire or die, they groom someone to take their place.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very secret. They don't answer to anybody. Their budget is probably all black ops. And, you know, they have, you know, carte blanche and for everywhere around the world. And are probably not only members of the United States, but as far as I understand, like I said, when I was in the Middle East, they're also members of this group from you know, Saudi Arabia and from a number of the Arab countries and European countries. And it's an international sort of organization. It's not restricted to the United States. So there would be no disclosure because, you know, one section may have to answer to the other. And it's not the United States government that's covering. It's this organization that's probably spread across the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's, yeah, exactly. So wouldn't be the choice of the president. He would be overruled by these organizations.
Yeah, the president of the United States is like a CEO. I mean, he has an idea of what's going down in research down in, you know, the laboratories, but he has no idea how the scientists are doing it. And a lot of things the CEO doesn't even want to know, as long as he sees the money figures coming in. And he's like the public representative to the people and to the stockholders as to what's going on in the company. President is the same way. Very privileged, probably privileged to not that much information. It's an elected official. And you're dealing with people who are, like I said, who are in positions for life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Now, obviously, there's a lot of talk about 2012 and all that stuff. And I mean, we don't necessarily need to go there. But it does seem like, as you say in the book, that these contact experiences are increasing. It seems like maybe there's a, for lack of a better term, there's a quickening going on towards something. I mean, what's the feeling that you get about all that?
The feeling I get is that's probably true. I think we're in an age where things are going to change radically in the way we perceive the universe. For example, these other dimensions, these other things may overlap periodically. It may be a cyclic type of event.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you know, 1,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, and so on, the idea of mythical creatures popped up, like gargoyles and gnomes and fairies and this and that.
Yeah.
Today, we look back at those stories and we think that they are just legends and so on. But to the people of that time, if you read some of the accounts and some of the truth and the fears, to them, they were all very real creatures. I mean, it wasn't a matter that they were legends. People were actually encountering these things. But we're doing it today. But it seems to be increasing. Perhaps there are periodic times in human history where these dimensions overlap, allowing phenomena from this other reality, this other dimension, to merge in with ours, and we start experiencing all of this phenomena. Maybe it's happening again. If this is true, in the next several years, our concept of what reality really is may start to change again, and we might start developing legends again, that someday in the future maybe looked at as, oh, the crazy legends and stories of the people who lived in the 20th century and the 21st century.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as you were saying all that, I was thinking that, too, because it was like, you know, maybe in 100 years from now, we still won't have any answers, but they'll look back and say, you know, what we think the UFO phenomenon is now will have changed into something else. And they'll say, well, back in the turn of the 20th century, you know, they thought it was UFOs. They called them UFOs, and, you know, they thought they were aliens, and now, you know, they're doing something completely different. So, you know.
Well, not only that, it's you know, when people look at the paranormal today, because they don't understand the end UFOs, they start to attribute supernatural or religious significance to it.
Mm-hmm.
This is what people have done, human beings have done for centuries. When they encounter a phenomenon or something they don't understand, they can't explain it, they attribute it with a supernatural being or God. We're doing the same thing today with UFOs and other aspects of the paranormal. Perhaps someday in the future, we're going to understand all this. We're going to understand the nature of the multidimensional universe and look back at this time and say, gee, you know, they were all foolish people. They let their own fears, you know, make their decisions for them and so on. But you see, the way I can do, you know, alchemy and astrology was back in, you know, thousands of years ago, was a mixture of wide ideas and sort of like supernatural ideas and a lot of hocus-pocus stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But out of those things, a science was born.
Yeah.
Today, I think we're seeing the same thing. someday in the future, we may understand the idea of the multidimensional universe and a new science of the late 21st century or even the 22nd century may be born. And as far as 2012, you know, is concerned, and let me put it this way, if nothing happens, you know, on the winter solstice in 2012, I'm going to be awful disappointed. Yeah, I've been building this one up for a long time. I want to see something happen.
Yeah.
But there are concerns that, you know, there are things changing on this planet very quickly, and there are things changing which could have dire results for the human race. So I guess we'll just have to see. But then again, you know, if you look out through history, human beings have gone through periods of doomsday over and over and over again. But this is the first time that there are quite a few things that are scheduled for 2012 that I think are more than coincidence. One of the things that concerns me the most, and, you know, I do a lot of research up at MIT and so on.
Yeah.
One of the things that it's concerning the scientists up there is that the sun has been awful quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun balances itself out. We're supposed to be in a sunspot maximum right now. A sunspot is a very rare event on the sun. There's practically no activity. The sun has a tendency to catch up to itself.
Yeah.
So hopefully, you know, we're not going to see the sun all of a sudden expel, you know, 22 years of energy all in, you know, 1 week.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the sort of thing. The sun has a tendency to catch up, so it's going to become very active, no doubt. I mean, this is the way the laws of physics work in the cores of stars. Also, another thing happening in 2012 twice is Venus crossing the face of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that's an interesting thing to be taking place in 2012 also. And the fact, you know, I don't know if you heard that the magnetic pole is shifting so fast that planes are having problems with their navigation systems.
Yeah, they had to shut down an airport to adjust the runway.
Yeah, I mean, this is happening. This is also happening on a scale in the military also. And also the orbit of the Earth is wobbling more. And, you know, we're lining up with the giant black hole in the center of the galaxy. I mean, there are a lot of factors to consider that have never happened before in human history, which I find, you know, quite interesting and also a little disturbing.
Yeah.
So we shall see.
Yes, we'll be riding through the storm and see what happens, I guess, right?
Well, I hope it's something good. I mean, you know, I would like to see these dimensions merge into each other and all of these guys come out of there. All of these elves and creatures of mythical lore come out and say, look, people, we're really here. Boy, would that shake our reality.
Absolutely, yeah. I would be totally on board with that. So I'd be a big fan of that. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention here, I wanted to ask you about before I let you go, is on the back of the book, it says you've appeared on Oprah.
Well, that was before she was, you know, a big star.
Oh, okay.
It was back in 1983.
Okay, so she was first starting out almost, or back in, like, getting started.
Let's see, Bud was on also, Bud Hopkins, and they did one little segment of the Hudson Valley UFOs, and they show the videotape of the Hudson Valley UFO. And, you know, that was probably my big contribution in my experience with Oprah. The only time I really talked to her is when I was sitting down talking to her for about 5 minutes, but that's about it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, she was a nice person, but, you know. This is before she became a superstar.
Yeah, yeah, before she became
When her show was out of Chicago, and it wasn't really, it was just starting to become nationwide.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I figured I'd ask in case, you know.
She's not interested in UFOs.
It seems that way, yeah. It seems like she's
But there
not.
Are a lot of celebrities who are interested in UFOs that have talked to me regarding their UFO encounters. Well, one of them is Geraldo. I mean, you know, he had a UFO encounter. I was on his show some years ago, and he told me privately of his encounter that he had.
Oh, wow.
Exciting.
Interesting.
So, you know,
they're out
a lot
there.
Of things going on out there. Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, what's going to happen now is that there's so much dissension and so much problems in the UFO field right now. A lot of these people involved with UFO research, they, you know, they say, well, the government's doing this to stop us and everything like that. I don't think so. UFO people involved with UFO investigation form these groups and these clans, and they give each other so much trouble. The government doesn't have to step in. They just screw it all up themselves.
Yeah, ufology's his own worst enemy. That's definitely the case, you know, but between the chirp wars
and
everything else.
I think that I'm a government plant.
Yeah, you mentioned that in the book, yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that's like the classic, you know, that's the classic smear of any argument in ufology is, you know, who's going to draw first on the government agent claim.
And, of course, this is, you know, one of the reasons why I don't appear in very many UFO conferences, because the whole thing is it's just filled with a lot of paranoia, and there's a lot of arguing, and people aren't working together. And I think more or less, you know, egos are on the line. And some people, I even think there's a point of jealousy also. Some people, if someone gets involved with a really good case, it seems that some other people get jealous and they try to put the case down and try to support the person to try to get the evidence out there and to help with the case. So, and also I think that there are also, in the paranormal in particular, there are just too many people out there who want their own reality show.
Yeah.
And some of these reality shows are ridiculous. For example, a number of them have contacted me asking me to come on the show or do segments with them. I turned them down because, you know, the show, I told them on the line, the shows are actually absolutely ridiculous and I won't have any part in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it seems like, especially with all these shows, too, they want you to... You know, they'll fly you in, but they're not going to pay you or anything like that. And then if you say no, then they're like, well, who can we get for free? I've heard stories from people who actually
said that. Oh, yeah, exactly like that. I mean, they want everything. And, you know, they don't want to contribute anything to the research being done. And they don't understand why some people will not. Oh, it's a big thrill to be on TV. I mean, give me a break. But, yes, that's true. I mean... You know, they want something for nothing, and they won't contribute to the research. And the people that they can get for free are people looking for publicity. So they, you know, usually end up with some kind of screwed up program.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're getting like third tier people because they can't, you know, because the good researchers, you know, they know the score of the game. So.
Yeah, and many of these shows are scripted, and they're also the people involved are. I think they get them in casting calls.
Who's this? The
they're not even some of the people involved in the shows are that they get them in casting calls. They're not even they haven't even done anything in research.
Yeah, I've seen some shows where they, you know, they have researchers on, and I've never even heard of them. And I've, you know.
Oh yeah, they get them in casting calls. They look good, and you know, and they're young and everything, and. It's actually pretty funny. But then again, you know, Hollywood's going to do whatever it can to make a buck on whatever popular.
That's true. That's true. Well, before we say goodbye here, what's coming up for you? You said The Vengeful Djinn is coming soon, and you got another book coming in December?
Yeah, in March, The Vengeful Djinn, which is a groundbreaking book, it's a dynamic book, is coming out. And then in December of 2011, portals, multidimensional portals, it's the origin of paranormal phenomena. That's coming out in December. And I'm working on a manuscript now that's due at the publisher, which will probably come out in 2012. It's called, right now, Files from the Edge 2, Haunted Places.
Oh, nice.
And that's on the horizon, plus a number of projects that I'm working on with Rosemary Ellen Guiley and research that I'm doing involving being able to detect and being able to monitor the idea of multidimensional portals in some way. So... Still busy.
Absolutely, yeah. Sounds so like interdimensional portals, almost like these like window zone areas that we've heard about in the past.
Yeah, and in that book, I really get into the physics behind it and various equipment that I'm designing right now.
Oh, nice.
to help with the research and the investigation. So I believe those two books are going to be groundbreaking books, and we'll see, you know. But if 2012 is the end of the world, doesn't really leave me much room for royalties, does it?
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens, I guess. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. Yeah. Well, I look forward to it, and if you and Rosemary are interested, I'll definitely have you guys on, you know, later on this season to talk about the Djinn book, because, I held...
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, for sure, yeah, then, definitely, because I held back a little bit here on the Djinn discussion, because I know the book's coming soon, so there'll be a lot of information there in that, and also held back a little bit on this Portal stuff, because I know you got the other book coming out. Both subjects are very interesting to me, so hopefully we can have you on in the future to talk about those, and your remarkable history in this field, because we just barely sort of scratched the surface a little bit on the sociological and historical aspect, and you've seen so much in the last 30 years that I would love to just talk to you about that kind of stuff as well. So, this 2 hours have flown by, and I just loved it. I love talking to you. So,
oh, you did a great job.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
The quickest 2 hours that I've ever done.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I tried to make it as conversational as possible, and I think it turned out really well. So, as I said in the introduction, I like to think of you as an unsung legend in this field. You're not out for the glory. You're not out for, the publicity and stuff. You're out to get to the bottom of this mystery. You're also daring enough to look at these outlier cases, which I think we need more people to do. And we need more people to, put their finger in all the different paranormal pies so we can figure out who this chef is. And
that's right.
And that's what you're doing, and I really have a lot of respect for that, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Okay. Thanks.
So, that does it for this installment of BOA Audio Season 6. Big thanks to Phil Imbrogno for coming on the show and giving us so much extra time. You definitely want to check out his books, Night Siege, The Hudson Valley UFO Sightings, Files from the Edge, Interdimensional Universe, and his latest book, Ultra Terrestrial Contact. You can find out more from Phil at his author's page at Llewellyn Books. Just punch in LLEWELLYN.com and then search for Phil Imbrogno, IMBROGNO. Check out his stuff, folks. I'm telling you, it will blow your mind. Moving right along, it's time for BOA Audio listener feedback, and it feels like it's been forever since I talked to you guys. So we're only going to do one email, and from there it will segue into two big issues I want to discuss with you all. The email comes from Ben in North Carolina, and here's what he has to say. I have enjoyed many of your interviews over the past few years. Thanks for all your time, effort, and expertise. Your style allows for guests to bring out much information and insight that they have in their field. I'm concerned that you're losing interest in providing this valuable service. Over the last 2 or 3 years, the available sites that provide this vital alternative viewpoint have decreased perilously close to zero. Your offerings have also decreased significantly in number. Sometimes it is weeks between new interviews. Please don't give up. Hosts such as Henrik Palmgren and Kevin Smith are finding new, interesting researchers to enlighten us. Thanks for your programming. Sincerely, Ben in North Carolina. Well, first of all, thank you for writing in, Ben. I really appreciate your kind words about the program, and I also appreciate your concerns about the program. I'm also very sure that your concerns are echoed by the many, many BOA Audio listeners, not just in America, but of course around the world. First and foremost, let me assure you all that I have certainly not lost interest in exploring the paranormal. I'm certainly not bored with the esoteric, my friends. The real problem here is simply a matter of time. As the folks who listen to our sister program, the Popcast Initiative, know, I picked up a little side gig over the holidays to make some extra money for the holiday season, and in turn ended up staying on at the job throughout January and onward here into February. And it seemed like things were going pretty good at first. We had a pretty good balance between BOA and this gig and my other gigs, but it all sort of came crashing down around mid-January and has really tightened up on me here over the last 2 or 3 weeks. I cannot tell you how frustrating and disappointing it is for me to be so late on getting these episodes out to you guys.
quite frankly, it's embarrassing, and I'm embarrassed that the show has gone so far off the rails here in season six. I kind of knew going into the year here that this was going to be a sort of bridge year for me, where we try to get things up and running on a number of big, big projects for the future, while also maintaining BOA's standard of excellence. But to be honest with you folks, I have let the ball drop in a big way, and I am well aware of this. It has been eating at me over the last couple of weeks, and it has been stressing me out beyond belief. So I have begun to sort of take steps to fix the situation. I don't want to get too deep into it, but the gist of it is that I'm looking for a new side gig that will be much more flexible schedule-wise and will allow me to really bring the focus back to BOA. This is an absolute must, my friends, because I'm not going anywhere, BOA is not going anywhere, and it's time to get back on track here with Banal of America. That said, I've learned over the years that when I make a promise to you guys that by the time it comes to fruition, it's quite mutated, especially when it comes to timeline stuff. So bear with me. That's all I'm asking you guys. Bear with us for another few weeks as we try to get this thing straightened out and as we try to get BOA back on track. I am certainly not losing interest in the world of the paranormal, and I am definitely not running into a lack of interesting researchers to talk with. In fact, right now I've got a slew of interviews in the can already taped with some fantastic researchers who are waiting for their episodes to be posted at Banal of America. So the programming continues, the show continues, do not worry. We're going through a little bit of a rough patch, but nobody knows that better than yours truly, the captain of the ship, and I am steering us towards some calmer waters. That is sort of, I guess you could say, the state of the program right now. We are aiming to get the next episode out to you in a week. Worst case scenario, it comes out to you in the next 10 days. And hopefully, moving forward, we can get this thing back on the right track. I sincerely apologize to all the people out there who may have had their faith questioned a little bit about this program. It's been six long years, my friends. BOA has established itself as one of the premier paranormal radio programs on the planet. And part of that is because we want to bring you the very best week in and week out. I could put together some real crap shows and bring in some real lousy guests for you just to say that we did an episode, but I don't want to do that. Each episode here in Season 6 is going to be the very best that I can do. But with that said, I also realize that you guys don't want to wait 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks, for a new episode. That is absolutely unacceptable for me, and it's absolutely unacceptable to you guys out there who have supported this program for so very long. So once again, I want to apologize for the delay between episodes, and I want to assure you that BOA is not going anywhere. Now that I've bolstered your spirits, allow me to deflate the balloon a little bit here with some depressing but inevitable news. Without getting into the nitty-gritty legal details of it all, the gist of it is we can't use popular music anymore at the beginning of the program. And we are actively looking right now for a new theme song for the show. So, in a way, the bad leads to the good. If you're a musician out there listening and you want to contribute something, we'd love to be able to use your material as a BOA audio theme song. I'm also kind of leaning towards just a pure theme song for the program that we can use week in and week out at the beginning of the show. I had a feeling this was eventually going to bite us in the ass. I thought the program was sort of under the radar enough that it would not become an issue, and since the show is free, I really didn't see the harm in what we were doing, but there are a lot of legal issues involved in that sort of thing, and they just don't like people using popular music without compensation for the artists. And I totally understand that, and I can respect that, and as such, we'll be removing all popular music from the BOA Audio Archive. Personally, I'm really disappointed by this turn of events, but at the same time, on the bright side, for the folks who are really getting frustrated with the delays between episodes, you'll be happy to know that eliminating the introductory musical mix for each episode will probably cut down a good 2 to 3 hours of production time for the show. And given the way things have been so tight for us here in Season 6, that is probably for the best. Apologies to Phil Imbrogno, who kind of got caught up in the storm here and didn't even get any music as an intro for the program this week, but we sort of found out the news about this popular music issue right around production time on the episode and had to scramble to figure out what we were going to do for this particular show. Nonetheless, summing it all up, BOA Audio still going strong. We're cognizant of the issues facing the program right now and are working diligently behind the scenes to make things run smoother. And we're in the market for a new BOA Audio theme song, particularly something that we could use week in and week out. That does it for the listener feedback portion of the show. I really wanted just to talk to all you guys out there here this week because I know it's been a while since you heard from me. I've gotten a lot of concerned emails from folks who are not just concerned about the program, but about me in general. I'm doing fine, folks, just very tired, very worn out, and just worked to the bone over the last few weeks, and am frustrated with the way things are going here at BOA HQ. But from that frustration, I'm confident that we will emerge stronger and better and sleeker than ever. If you want to get in touch with me, there are a number of ways to do it. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to binallofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the contact button. And the final method, of course, is to join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. Awesome group of folks there talking about the paranormal and the world of pop culture as well. Join up and join in on the discussions at theusofe.com. Beyond that, I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, so befriend me or poke me or follow me. It's all good, and I'd love to be in touch with you via those social networks. Provided that things go a little smoother next week, and how could they not at this point, we will bring back BOA Audio listener feedback with a whole bunch of new emails from the outrageous and awesome BOA Audio listeners. Up next, it is the thanks portion of the program. Allow me to tip my cap and give thanks to the amazing and esteemed BOA staff. Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Marla Pena, our contributing cartoonist Andy Carolin, and our webmaster Jeremy Boston. I also want to welcome our newest columnist who will be debuting this coming week, Bruce Priddy, with The Paranormal Apostate. So stay tuned to BOA for that. The BOA staff has contributed a whole bunch of new columns since the last time you heard me, including the return of Marla Pena with a recap of her 2010, Leslie's examination of the dead friends on Facebook phenomenon, Rochelle Hawk's look at the meme that was the change in the zodiac that went around at the end of January, and Regan Lee's recounting of her conversation with her mother regarding Mothman. And I've got a whole bunch of other stuff from the BOA staff in my to-do column, so we're going to get a whole bunch of new stuff posted from them over the next few days and weeks as well. And, of course, once again, stay tuned to BOA for the debut of The Paranormal Apostate by Bruce Priddy, as well as a couple of other new columns due to appear at BOA in the next few weeks. We say it at the end of every episode, but it bears repeating once again, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA audio and you're not reading the columns at Binall of America, then you're only getting half the story. BOA, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Given the ridiculous delay between episodes here of BOA Audio, I would really not feel comfortable asking for folks to make a donation to BOA, so I will hit you up for donations next episode, provided that I feel a little less guilty about how long it takes us to produce the program for you all. And finally, let's take a look at what's coming up for you on the next installment of BOA Audio. We're going to be welcoming back our old friend, Dr. Bob Curran, direct from Northern Ireland, to talk about his new book, Man-Made Monsters, talking about the inspirations for the Frankenstein story. There were a lot of real-world situations that lent themselves to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. We'll also talk about the Golem. We'll discuss alchemy. We'll hear about ancient computers and robots. We'll also cover the Voynich manuscript and Dr. Bob Karn's previous book, Dark Fairies. It's an interesting mix of myth, legend, history, and gothic horror in a lot of ways. A lot of really cool and interesting stuff there in the episode from Dr. Bob Karn. He is a master storyteller and really unleashes some remarkable information for us about not just man-made monsters, but what these man-made monsters say about the men who make them. That's next week on BOA Audio, Dr. Bob Karn talking about man-made monsters. And on that note, we close the book on another edition of BOA Audio Season 6. Big thanks once again to Phil Imbrogno for coming on the show. Big thanks to Ben in North Carolina for writing in for BOA Audio listener feedback. And, of course, super huge thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who have been waiting patiently to hear from me once again. I really appreciate your support in a huge, huge way. Without you guys, we would simply be nothing at all. So allow me to humbly thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Benall, thanking you for listening and signing off.